Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Rowan and Martin's laugh-in change television? Long before the hackneyed phrase must-see TV entered the lexicon, NBC's sketch comedy show was exactly that, a reason for people to tune in on Monday nights in order to know what everybody would be talking about the rest of the week. Laugh-In was famous for its unprecedented array of guest stars, including, perhaps infamously for some, the brief star turn that Richard Nixon later said helped him win the U.S. presidency. The show made stars of people like Ruth Buzzi, Lily Tomlin, Artie Johnson, and Goldie Hawn, hooked Americans on the joys of the catchphrase, and deftly mixed political humor, sexual innuendo, and recurring character sketches.
There is no big finish, folk.
Doing the Laugh-In show is my second favorite thing in the whole world. My first is having an unclean yak sit on my dinner.
Well, Mr. Robinson, how do you feel about appearing on a comedy show?
Sounds like a good idea. You know one?
Wherever I go, all over the world, people are always asking me about Laugh-In. And they all ask the same question. Why?
I know that there are millions of good people watching Laugh-In tonight. And I want to remind all of you that the family that watches Laugh-In together really needs to pray together.
And now, folks, here they are, the stars of Laugh-In, two of the nicest guys I've ever had the pleasure of working with, Dan Rowan and the beautiful Dick Martin. I can't read it on air because it's not true. I don't know who they are.
Little sound there, a little mashup from Laugh-In. And yes, you get 10 points if you recognize the voice of the late Reverend Billy Graham among the guest stars. Joining us now to talk about the show and its legacy today is the man who created Laugh-In. Producer and director George Slaughter already has Golden Globes, Directors and Producers Guild Awards, and 5 Emmys. He'll be in town tomorrow to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award from the Dallas Video Fest tomorrow night. Currently, he joins us from the studios of NPR West. George, welcome. Welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be here.
You have said that the thing that drew you to a career in television was this idea that anything could happen.
Yes, it's a powerful medium, and it's been a lot of fun.
And there was also the sort of excitement of things happening that weren't as edited as television often is today.
This is true. We developed all kinds of new techniques for editing, and Laugh-In was a lot of Laugh-In was accident. Whatever happened on stage, we found a way to use it. It was like a free fall. It was television without a net.
That's a rare quality for a producer, to be open to those accidents and think of them as serendipitous as opposed to calamitous.
We weren't open to them. We provoked them. Somebody wanted to do a show once of Laugh-In outtakes, and I said, "Are you kidding? I aired my outtakes." Laugh-In was an outtake, you know.
Did you
what?
Oh, please continue. Sorry.
No, every week we started with a very long script that had all kinds of bits and pieces and departments and characters and so forth, and that we would tape that material. But if in the meantime something went wrong, Bob Hope came in once to do a plug for his special, and he hadn't seen the show yet. And while he was in the middle of his plug, Artie Johnson came out as the little German, and he said, "Mr. Hope, every Christmas we waited for you. You never came to the bunker." And Hope looked at him like, "What the hell? What are you doing here?" And then Bob Hope became the Hope that we all thought he was. He stood there with Artie for about 4 minutes and just ad-libbed, and it was brilliant. So we aired the whole thing.
Did you go into the show imagining that Laugh-In would be exactly what it became?
Well, you always hope. I had done a ton of television before Laugh-In. I'd done the Judy Garland series and the Dinah Shore series and the Grammy Awards and a whole bunch of television. But I really wanted to do something that would feed back on the culture and that would take advantage of the young character comedians that weren't stand-up comics and weren't used in a sitcom where they could just do one character. It was not as effective as they could be. Lily walked in with about 30 characters, and so did Artie and Ruth and so we did them all. And only by a show like Laugh-In that was done in these brief bursts could we take advantage of all of that talent.
Yeah, the pacing of that show was so quick that it was unlike a lot of other sort of variety shows that TV had ever seen.
Uh, You see, at that point, it was just the beginning of the editing that we now have. We didn't even have time code, so we cut by a little voice that said 1001, 1002. And the cuts were so fast that we had to edit the first pass on the kinescope on film and then edit the videotape to match it. So it was a brilliant woman by the name of Carolyn Raskin who did the editing, and she developed many of the techniques that are used today. And when you look at Laugh-In today, you go, well, that's still pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just the speed of it. It was the sense of a free fall. It was the sense that you were watching something that was dangerous, and you were.
What were the sort of network standards, people? What did they make of the show?
Well, they didn't really want to air. They didn't want it in the first place. I made a deal with them where I would do one of the shows they wanted me to do if they would let me do one show my way. And they said okay, but they didn't really mean it. And so we arrived with this group of people who I'd seen over a period of time, and they showed up to read the script. Nobody knew who they were. Dan and Dick were a fairly well-known nightclub act, but the rest of the people, nobody knew them. So we stopped people in the hall to get them to say, you know, sock it to me or whatever. And when we took it into the network the first time, they were noticeably kind of upset. They said, what is this? I said, well, this isn't a television show. This is an accident. And I said, you're right. So, but they were very nervous about it. So they put it on following the Miss America contest where they had no program to put in there. And they kind of just threw it in. And it didn't do anything because we didn't have big names on it then. But it went on the air and caused quite a commotion. And so then they needed something to put on opposite Lucille Ball and Gunsmoke, which were the one and two shows on the air at the time. So we were kind of cannon fodder, and they just tossed it in there. And about the fourth week, we got Sammy Davis did Here Come the Judge. And the next morning in the Supreme Court, when the judges came in, there was somebody in the back said, Here Come the Judge. And the whole court broke up. It hit the news, and they said, look what you've done. So that was the beginning of it.
Well, it's interesting that you say that you know, you heard these reports. These days, almost in real time, a producer, a writer can find out how audiences are responding to the thing you've created. But you didn't have any of that online media back then. What did you listen to? Who did you pay attention to sort of know how the show had done beyond simply what the ratings might tell you?
You found out right away by the press, and you found out by the phone calls. The network, we went on the air one time and we said, News of the Future, Vatican, Dateline. They said, with marriage in the church now an accepted practice, the Archbishop and his lovely bride, the former Sister Mary Catherine, both announced this time it's for keeps, if only for the sake of the children. Well, the network went crazy. They said, do you know what happened last night? I said, yeah. They said, the phone's lit up like crazy. If we jammed the switchboard, I said, how many people called you last week? They said that it caused such a commotion. And it wasn't really sacrilegious. It was just a comment about what might happen in the future, which, in fact, it did. You know? They were very nervous.
Didn't News of the Future actually predict the presidency of Ronald Reagan?
Yeah. Yeah. We said Dateline Washington, and we said President Ronald Reagan, and he at that point was the governor. And we wound up pretty good friends. He told Paul Keyes, who was very close to Nixon, he said, you tell that Slaughter that I think he's got a quota on Ronald Reagan jokes, and you tell him I said so, and I want to know what he said. So Paul came back kind of terrified at this, and I said, well, you tell the governor that he's right. I do have a quota on Ronald Reagan jokes, but as yet I've never been able to meet my quota. And we wound up eventually very, very good friends. He loved jokes, and Nancy and I are still good friends. So although we didn't agree politically, we sure had a good time together.
All right, so I have to do this to you. We have to let's play Richard Nixon's star turn on Laugh-In.
NBC, beautiful downtown Burbank. Oh, hello, Governor Rockefeller. Oh, no. I don't think we could get Mr. Nixon to stand still for a socket to me.
Sock it to me?
I think everybody knows that moment of television. It is one of the most famous of the 20th century. First of all, what did it take to get Richard Nixon, who was not a man well known for his keen sense of humor about himself?
No. His best friend was a man by the name of Paul Keyes, and Paul Keyes was one of the writers. And we wanted to do something on the first show the next year that would be kind of provocative. And we asked him, he said, could you get Mr. Nixon? And he said, well, we'll try. So we just went over to CBS, where he was shooting some promos. And we told him what we wanted him to do. And the people around him said, there's no way you're going to do that. You can't. We shouldn't. You know? And so we went over and decided, well, why don't you try it? And so he did the sock it to me. We took 5 takes to get him to look kind of friendly. And he smiled and said, sock it to me. And then we took that tape out of there and left like a porch climber and brought it back and put it on the air. And people did say that it was probably what helped him get elected, and I've had to live with that.
did he know the show? Like, had he seen it? Had he heard about it from his kids?
Oh yeah. By then, everybody had heard about it. Everybody had heard because it was controversial and it was provocative and it was bawdy, but it wasn't really naughty, and it was kind of sexy, but not sexist, you know? And we did have Goldie in a bikini with words painted on her, like today's, tattoos. But she was, she was this very thin, gorgeous, cute little girl, and I used to tease. I said, how could that be sexy with a girl with 2 backs? And It was provocative, and when you watched it, it was so fast that you thought maybe you'd missed something, and so you almost had to look at it again. So they really didn't know what to think of it. But by the time they figured it out, it had become such a big hit that they couldn't do anything about it.
And you did ask Hubert Humphrey.
Yeah, I followed him all over the country. We had taping set up everywhere he went. I said, please answer Richard Nixon. Say, you know, what a good idea. Let's do sock it to him. And Hubert Humphrey later said he thought that may have been what cost him the election. And I've had to live with that. There's a lot of guilt involved in my career.
What role did you want music to play in the show?
Well, the music was the background. At this point, it was not a variety show. It was a comedy show, and the music was all written by Billy Barnes and a guy named Ian Bernard, and they wrote all special material. We didn't do any straight songs at all. And on one of the shows before it went on the air, Cher was one of the guest stars because we had been very friendly. And she came in and read this all-comedy script, and she'd never worked alone before, and Sonny wasn't on the show. And she laughed. She had a wonderful, wonderful time. And I went over afterwards, and Sonny said, George, where's Cher's song? And I went, oh, my God, he doesn't realize there are no songs. And so I said to Billy Barnes, this sweet, wonderful, talented man, I said, Billy, where is Cher's song? And Billy looked at me like I'd slapped him. And I said, Cher's song. I said, you know, where this came from, I don't know. I said, you know, the Mountie number. And Tim Conway was the guest. I said, oh, come on here. I'll take Billy in here. I know where it is. Come on, Billy. We go in. He said, what are you talking about? I said, Billy, write me a Mountie number. He said, "What?" I said, "Well, you know, we'll have Tim Conway as the Mountie, and she'll take his hat off, and the strap will get caught under his nose." And Billy said, "George, that's not a song; that's a joke." I said, "Billy, I don't do songs; I do jokes." And so they did it. She laughed, and I had Billy write the song. He wrote the song in 10 minutes, and then they thought it was so great they used him in the future.
Producer and director George Slaughter is my guest. He is the creator of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In and will join us again after the break. I do want to apologize and thank those of you who have written in to correct my mistake, having referred to the late Reverend Billy Graham. The Reverend Graham is alive and well, and I deeply apologize for my error. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
Governor Reagan is really worried about earthquakes in California. He's afraid Berkeley may shift even further to the left.
All the kids in my school are really proud of the astronauts. Imagine to stay that high for that long.
Reverend Mother, get over here quickly. There's a bunch of people here and they're all flying.
Sonny and I are perfectly compatible. As soon as there's a problem, my psychiatrist contacts his psychiatrist and they work it out.
My church welcomes all denominations, but my favorite is the $5 bill.
I tried to join the sexual revolution, but I flunked the physical.
A little more there from Ronan Martin's Laugh-In. We are speaking this hour with its creator, producer, and director George Slaughter, who will be in town this weekend to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award from the Dallas Video Fest. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. George, do you have like a working theory about chemistry, chemistry between writers, chemistry between people who will appear together on camera?
Oh, boy, that's a long discussion. Yeah, I mean, it's all about chemistry and it's all about magic. And you can't predict it. You can't plan it. You can't really create it. It happens. I mean, Goldie Hawn walked into the office and I said, I want you to do all the shows. And she hadn't done that kind of show. Lily Tomlin came in for an interview, and we sat there for 3 hours, and she did all her characters. I think the secret is you have to be receptive. If you look at your life like a funnel, the big end out, little end coming in, you have to absorb. And you have to be aware. The clips that you just ran, in that brief clip montage, there were maybe 12 different subjects discussed, and some of them controversial, some of them silly. And those people were just love people. A lot of it was working into camera, and a lot of it was people who had secrets, you know. And just looking at those clips brought back such wonderful memories. A lot of that. I'm doing a book now. It's called Still Laughing, But It Wasn't All My Fault. and it collects a lot of those stories, and reliving those moments has been a very pleasant experience. The secret. It's all about secrets. You know, people are interesting by what they don't tell you.
Really? Even in something like comedy, when we hear secret, we think of something sort of dark. Is that still behind even silly comedy?
Dark is okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people themselves have secrets. When you watched Goldie, you didn't know why she was laughing. And one reason for it was Goldie was as bright as any woman I've ever met, mm-hmm. but she was easily distracted. And while anything else was going on, she was aware of what she was doing and of what else was going on. And that we would feature that, and that made her laugh. Artie Johnson was short and did all of these accents, and nobody knew what he was saying. And we would do a piece with Artie Johnson, and the next morning they would bring in linguists to try to find out what he had said. Well, that was exciting, and we had fun. It was a big, big playground. And that was the secret, just to let people do what they can. So find a bunch of talented people and then try to find a way to let them do what they can do. I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing.
Let's listen back to one of those characters that I think people still remember today. And this is Lily Tomlin doing Ernestine. Oh.
One ringy dingy. Is this Mr. Hoover? Mr. Jedgar Hoover? Good. Then I have reached the party to whom I am speaking. Mr. Hoover, this is Miss Tomlin from the telephone company. It is my duty, Mr. Hoover, to discuss with you some of the abuses of your instrument. Yes. Yes, it does sound rather un-American, doesn't it? Now then, Mr. Hoover, I have your file here before me. Oh, yes, I'm sure that you have a file on me, too. After all, turnabout is fair play. Yes, it does sound perverted.
That is Lily Tomlin doing Ernestine on Laugh-In. You know, when you hear her there, like, very often, I think for lay people, we sort of understand that timing exists, but it's hard to point out when it's happening. But that sketch is such a perfect example of the exact right beat before she moves on, and she's working alone.
Yes, and the interesting thing is that the things Lily was talking about in 1969-70 exist today. We still have the same situations. A lot of the jokes we did then were prophetic, and Lily captured it better than almost anyone. She's one of the most brilliant actresses I've ever worked with, and one of the loveliest people. And we would have great fun. She would go out and do this, and people were afraid of getting a call from Ernestine. And that also made the adventure more fun, you know.
How did it work when an actor came in with characters that he or she had created? How did that happen in the writer's room, and how much was written by the writers and how much was written by the performer?
Well, a man by the name of Digby Wolfe had a lot to do with the creation of Laugh-In. And we went in with a script. We went in with a script that was a full, sometimes a 200-page script. And we taped what we could. We shot all night long many times. And actors would come in, and they would do characters that they had. They would do situations that they were comfortable with. And the secret was in situations that they were not comfortable with. And it was television without a net. It was dangerous. And it was I don't think we have that today, because everything today is run by a committee, you know. The network never really was aware of what we were doing until they saw it. And they would come in with all kinds of cuts and changes and whatever. But we were such a big hit then. I mean, I'm arrogant now, but 45 years ago, I was a mess. So we would just go ahead and do it, and we'd put it on the air and wait for the explosion. I wish there was – I'm not too sure there is that kind of thing today, and it's kind of a shame, you know. We used writers that were not normal sitcom or variety show writers. One of them was a professor of political science in Bemidji. One of them was a cartoonist. It was just a mix of all these people that we'd found coming in and having their input.
Well, maybe that was the secret, bringing in people who didn't know what they were supposed to be doing so they could create something entirely new.
Well, yeah, in the beginning, they had never seen the show. So when they came in, they were people that I'd known either from when I worked in Vegas or from socially, and we just said, would they come in? And it would Billy Wilder and Jack Lemmon would come in, and they wanted to see what it was. And once the show was a hit, they wanted to come in and be part of it, you know. Jack Lemmon, we almost got anybody we wanted. And the Dr. Billy Graham thing, I'm glad he's still around. I don't know whether or not seeing that clip might be what puts him over the edge. But Truman Capote and Gore Vidal and William Buckley, we wanted to get him to do the show. And he said, not only do I refuse to appear, I resent having been asked. Well, eventually I said, all right, I agreed to fly him to Burbank in a plane with two right wings. And then he agreed to appear. And we wound up very good friends. See, it was a way of releasing kind of a pressure valve. 1968 was all of the same problems we have today. We haven't solved anything. We had a war. We had a president that wasn't at the peak of his popularity. We had political unrest, racial tension. All the same problems we had in 1968 exist today. Only today, nobody really is having fun with it. I'm not too sure you could today with the pressure groups and the censors and the networks and the sponsors. But we were such a big hit, nobody wanted to fool with it. And so they just let us go.
Did Lorne Michaels write for you early on?
Yeah, he was in Canada with Hart Pomerantz and Lorne Michaels. And Dan and Dick had heard of him, and we brought him down. And he wrote a lot of the stuff for Dan and Dick. Yeah.
It's interesting because SNL is maybe the closest thing, although it's highly produced, and I understand it's a pretty structured shop over there, but it's still television where theoretically anything can happen.
I like Saturday Night Live because it's a window for people that might not have another avenue to travel in order to get into television. And it's 90 minutes a week, and it's a window, and I think we can be proud that it is on the air. I just wish that there was more opportunity for that kind of show.
Do you think the reluctance of the networks to do any of this is about money, and everybody is so afraid of failing and losing money that they won't take a chance?
It's all of that. And then, of course, those jobs are kind of temporary, you know.
Yeah.
There's a saying goes, it's if at the network, if my boss calls, try to get his name. sometimes a producer's going to be there longer than the network. They're afraid. The fear of failure is there. And you don't have the autonomy that we had with, like, Herb Schlosser, who was running the network at that time. They would go in to see Herb and say, Herb, we're getting a lot of static. We're hearing from the right wing, the left wing, you've got to talk to this guy. And so I'd go in and say, Herb, how you doing? He said, well, they're giving me a lot of heat. And I said, what do you think? He said, just go do what you're doing. And it was his courage and so forth. People like Herb Schlosser and Fred Silverman don't have the control that they had. So the freedom comes with someone having the control to say, go ahead and do it. And then the courage or the arrogance to do it against all odds.
George Slaughter is with us, producer, director, and creator of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. He also has 5 Emmys to his credit. He's in town to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award from the Dallas Video Fest. Ernie Kovacs was actually a big influence on your early career.
Huge, huge. We knew Ernie socially, and Ernie met my wife Jolene, and he just fell in love with her, and he started doing stuff with Jolene before Laugh-In, actually. And I don't know whether you remember the Kovacs show, but he had a huge influence on me. One of the characters that he did every week was a girl, my wife, Jolene, sitting in a bathtub full of bubbles, and different things would come up through the bubbles, you know. A big dog, people, Harry Belafonte came out of there one time, just rising up through these bubbles. Well, the mind to conceive of that was just beautiful. So we spent a lot of time together, and he had a big influence on me. We didn't agree. I would constantly say to him, Ernie, you got to have a punchline. He didn't like punchlines. I say, Ernie, you're so close to a punchline. He says, no, I don't want to do that. So he called up one day and he said, come on over. I said, I'm in the middle of it. Never mind. Come on over. So I came over to the studio and he was standing on this raised stage doing a car commercial. And when he hit the fender of the car, it went through the floor. And he said, now, George, is that a punchline? I said, oh boy. He had a huge effect on me. He loved Jolene. He did terrible things to Jolene, you know, with pies and doors and all of that stuff. And they loved each other. And so I would spend a lot of time with Ernie. So he loved the medium, and he contributed enormously to the future and the advance of television.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go now to Ken calling from Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I've wondered this for years. You know, the kind of comedy that you see on Laugh-In, looking back at those episodes, it sort of survives in Saturday Night Live and of course, the Jimmy Fallon show in a way. I was wondering if you could speak generally about how tastes have changed, because how American tastes in comedy have changed. You don't see that kind of variety, burlesque, vaudeville sort of descended humor pretty much at all anymore. And sort of talk about, just generally speak about those sorts of issues. How have we changed? How has comedy changed?
You sound like you watched the show.
Were you a viewer, Ken? Oh, we lost Ken on the air. But
Sorry, Ken. Anyway, well, see, what I think what hurt comedy more than anything else, right? If you put your finger on one, it's the F word. Once they hit the F button, then everything started to fade, you know? And it wasn't, we never said any of the words that are not allowed. We did talk about the fabulous Farkle family, and we did talk about, look that up in your funkin' Wagnall, but that's about as close as we came. It was trying as many things as you could. In each show, we did maybe 200 different jokes, and some of them were in the background. Some of them were just graffiti written on a wall, and some of them were sound effects jokes. And it was an experience. You didn't just watch Laugh-In. The interesting thing is that we did things with silly little things that children enjoyed, and we did things with Goldie in a bikini and Judy Carn in a bikini that adults got a big kick out of. And in the middle, we did political humor, jokes about things that were just not generally being joked about, that the college students climbed onto. So we hit that broad cross-section. I think today You need somebody that doesn't care enough about failure to risk it. And we came real close many times.
What does it take to...
Matter of fact, I got to tell you one thing. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, our third week on the air, I got a call and they said, Seattle has just canceled the show. Now what are you going to do? And I said, we're going to take a crew to Seattle. I want to do a tribute to this station. I said, what? I said, anybody with a good taste to cancel this trash should be, you know, saluted. So they said, what do you mean? I said, we're putting a crew on the plane. We're going to go up to Seattle and do a documentary about the guy that was had the taste to cancel it. Anyhow, it was back on the air right away. They didn't want to have a tribute done to him. it was that kind of outrage. And this Digby Wolf was outrageous. And then we had this group of writers. It was a combination of talents that came together at a time when the country needed something to relieve the tension of the Vietnam War and the political mess we were in. And it just happened at the right time.
Was there anything that you declared off limits?
Taste. No, we were not in bad taste. We were right on the edge all of the time, you know.
Lots and of course exciting.
a lot of the jokes the network didn't understand until later, and they said, "What did that mean?" I said, "I don't know." And it was that we would have fun with, but not really make fun of. Of course, my favorite subject was politics, which has gotten even funnier. Gee, I just wish somebody... See, Bill Maher is great. I wish he was not good quite as far as he does. But Jon Stewart has made an enormous contribution, as has Stephen Colbert. I lack that kind of entertainment. I like seeing it. I really wish there was more of it because there's a lot to talk about. But now there's pressure groups that inhibit the producer a great deal.
George Slaughter is with us. He is producer and director and creator of Ronan Martin's Laugh-In, also of Real People, and he has directed multiple other shows. He'll be in town this weekend at the Dallas Video Fest to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award. We'll resume our conversation with George in just a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses. smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is producer and director George Slaughter. He is the recipient of 5 Emmy Awards, and he'll be in town to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award from the Dallas Video Fest. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. George, how often did you and your writers disagree over what belonged in the show or what deserved what placement in the show?
Constantly.
How'd you handle that?
Well, we would probably tape it both ways. And then Carolyn Raskin, this brilliant woman, would go down and put it all together. Laugh-In was not easy, and it was not always a smooth sailing. I mean, we had giant disagreements, and... But that out of those disagreements is part of what made it fun. That out of that came a lot of the fun. See, politically, we had writers on both sides, right and left, and in the middle, and that made it exciting too. Paul Keyes was as far right as you could get. He was doing cartwheels. He was Nixon's closest friend, and that gave a wonderful sense of combat to the proceedings. And Digby Wolf was as far the other way, you know. And putting them all in the same room led to some heated discussions. And out of that came the fun. Out of that came the flying close to the flame. And it happened at a time when the nation needed to laugh, right like we do now. We need something to laugh at. And you have Leno and you have Letterman, and these guys are wonderful. But they don't have that concentrated assault on society, you know. And I wish we had more of that.
How much TV do you watch these days?
I watch a lot. My favorite, because I watch a lot of Fox. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love Fox. I mean, I you know, I, I think that Sean Hannity and Bill. I met Bill O'Reilly one night, and he said, "Oh, he said I know who you are." He said, "I used to laugh at your show," and I said, "I know who you are, and I still laugh at yours." And so out of this came a wonderful relationship. I'll tell you another guy I like is Sean Hannity is really funny. We don't know it, but he is funny, you know. And of course, Rush Limbaugh is a balloon buffoon. He's a barrel of laughs. Well, he's a barrel anyway. I went on Neil Cavuto. I like Neil. He's a bright, bright guy, and he invited me on by mistake once. And he said, "Did I feel as the first person to have pushed the envelope? Did I feel responsible for the Janet Jackson wardrobe accident?" And I said, "Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I will accept responsibility for that." I said, however, Fox having put that on in every day part in slow motion and still and run it over and over and over again, thereby making certain that everybody of every age has seen that clip, and you can be you can take credit for having made Janet Jackson's right breast the most famous boob on television since Rush Limbaugh. Well, he said, thank you, George, and I was off. Bill Cosby called me and said, "Man, it'll throw white people off that fast." But I've had great fun with Neil. Out of those controversies, out of that conflict, is the root of a lot of humor. And I wish there was more of it. I'm surprised we haven't been canceled. We've been on the air for 45 minutes. It's the longest I've ever gone without the threat of cancellation. It's all in this book, Still Laughing, right? And I've had more fun writing it because I realize how close we were to the flame. And occasionally we got burned.
What did that feel like when there was a project that you really cared about that didn't do well, that got canceled? How did you learn to roll with the punches?
You heard about that, huh? Well, hey, if you're going to succeed, you have to risk failure. That's the secret of it, you know. And I did shows that I did a show called Speak Up America that I wish had stayed on the air, but it was just too far. It was the first show that interacted with the audience, and this was like 70. Mm-hmm. And there was a station in Cleveland had the an interactive kind of thing, and we could take a survey right while we were on the air and come back and give you the answer. That just frightened the network news departments. So that was painful that Speak Up America didn't stay on longer. But if you're going to succeed, you've got to risk failure. And the bigger the threat of failure is, the bigger the success can be.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to James on the line in Terrell. Hi, James.
Howdy. I'd like to share just really quickly that my son is 8 years old, and he's a very big fan of your television program, especially Laugh-In, a couple shows that he's been able to download off of YouTube. He is one of those afterthought children 20 years later that appreciates a monkey suit more than any other form of commie, if I might have to share. And he, over and over, listens to the Laugh-In record, the live from beautiful downtown Burbank recordings, if you recall, and
yep.
It's really kind of reintroduced that genre into our household.
Get me his address, and I will send some tapes to the young man and further distort his mind because he shows promise.
He also on your show actually was the first time we discovered a gentleman who is a recording artist. Under the late Frank Zappa, a guy named Larry.
Larry Hovis?
No, Larry Wildman Fisher?
Yes, oh yeah. Your son is weird, but I like him a lot. Chris, somehow get me this guy's address and I'll send him tapes. It'll further distort his education.
We will get that. Well, who knows? Maybe he'll be the next generation's George Slaughter. You never know.
If we can get him at 8 years old, we can keep him forever. You know, but it is interesting. The speed of it, the outrageous sense of it would still be appealing today to someone who has access to all of the stuff that's on the air. There's some great television shows on the air now, but I don't know what is on the air that would excite this 8-year-old. I don't know.
Did I read correctly that you were raised by a staunchly Republican father?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The White House was vacant the whole time that the Kennedys were in there. And they came to see me once, and they said, you know, we're surprised that you seem to be doing very well, but you never keep a job. You keep moving around all the time. I said, that's right. And they said, did I ever regret that I hadn't gone on to law school? And my mother was a concert violinist. My father was a salesman, and they were very staunch Republicans. They were a bit horrified occasionally at what I did, but they were fun. And they got used to it. America got used to it. You'll get used to it. Where are you?
We're in Dallas.
Okay. Are you going to be at this thing for Ernie Kovacs?
I hope to be there.
Please. I'm excited about doing it because Ernie was a dear, dear friend, and Ernie certainly had a big influence on me, and it's nice to know that they're still going to celebrate this genius. You know what we figured out the other day? I was talking to Edie Adams' son. I think I may be one of the only people still alive that worked with Ernie.
Wow.
He
died in 1962, kind of, right, or 64?
Yeah. And Jolene was doing his show, and that was a real jolt because she was about to have our daughter, Maria. And we never really quite recovered from that. It was a shame. But, boy, did we have great memories of him. Oh, fun we had. And with Edie, too, you know. So I'm looking forward to the thing in Dallas. I like Dallas anyway, in spite of that one little problem they had down there. But the rest of it is good.
Yeah, we can't quite shake that off 50 years later.
No, I don't think so. That'll stay with us forever, you know. They never did figure it out, did they? But anyway, I like Dallas, and I'm looking forward to coming down there, and particularly with a chance to relive some of the moments with Ernie.
So when you started in television, it was something that was very much for professionals only, and now there are kids out there shooting their own stuff and loading it onto YouTube. Do you think this is a good development? Is it a little closer maybe to what live television used to be, or live-to-tape television?
I think it is great. I'm a big fan of the Internet. These guys can go out now with a cell phone and shoot a movie.
Yeah.
And we need that input. It was closed for so long. You know, you had to be this and you had to have that. Kids can go out now and do some really wonderful things. I've seen things on the Internet that I love. I may do a whole show about right off the Internet. This one guy's walking along in a supermarket, and he hasn't been asleep. You can see he just is a mess. He hasn't shaved, and he's got this kid in this shopping cart throwing things and crushing things and yelling and screaming. The people in the audience, in the market, are looking like, oh, you poor guy. And after about 20 seconds of this, across the bottom of the screen, it says, use condoms. Well, that was done, I think, by a kid in school.
Mm-hmm.
So the window is open now to let all of this fresh air come in if we'll just accept it and find a place to put it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Clark in Weatherford. Hey, Clark.
Hello. I just wanted to ask your guest about his comments on that great show, That Was the Week There Was.
Yes.
And then there's another one on PBS called The Great American Dream Machine or something like that.
Yes, Great American Dream Machine was great. A guy by the name of Don Mischer, who worked for me later, was on that. And That Was the Week That was a brilliant show. And of course, it was done at a time when we didn't have access to the information. Now you can Google anybody and find out anything you need to know in just a few moments. Both of those were very worthwhile adventures. And I'm proud that television did it because they also had an effect on me. You know, That Was the Week That was a powerful, powerful show. But yeah, I'm glad you watched. You're aware there, aren't you? Where are you?
He is in Weatherford, Texas, which is a suburb of Fort Worth.
Okay, well, see, they get television there.
Yeah, they get it everywhere these days.
They get it everywhere.
I can't believe, George, we've gotten this far into the hour and not talked about the American Comedy Awards, which were your brainchild. Can you talk a little bit about what made you want to do this?
Well, it was just this love of comedy. The fact is that we need laughter. Laughter is the panacea. And the people who can make us laugh never really got the appreciation or expression of the appreciation. And I wanted to do a show that was just comics. And they go after a comic to host the Grammys or the Emmys or the Oscars and so forth, and then they forget about it. I wanted to do a show that was just paying some tribute and giving credit to the people who've made us laugh. And it was a thrill. I mean, it was great, and the fact that they went along and did it, and we did it for 15 years. Then what happened is after 9/11, comedy itself took a turn that I wasn't crazy about. It got dirtier and raunchier, and it was difficult to find the kind of clips that we needed, and so we stopped doing it. But It may come back again. We need it. We need something to honor these people who, we have some brilliant people out there who make us laugh, and we should pay more attention to them. But thank you for mentioning it.
Well, is Working Blue just sort of a cheap grab for laughs? Is that the problem?
It's too easy. See, once you throw one of those F-bombs, or once you do that, then nothing that follows that can be funny because they're waiting for the next one.
Yeah.
You know, how we avoided that was what really made laughing exciting and dangerous. It's too easy. And then you can never come back from that, you know. So if you can avoid that and still be funny. Of course, and there's also the question of visual humor. That was what Ernie was so brilliant at. You know, Ernie did great. One time he built a set on an angle. So when he sat at the table, he poured stuff into a glass and it went sideways. And you couldn't figure out what he did. He built the whole set sideways. Mm. Brilliant. And then he used to smoke cigars. And he went underwater and he had this cigar. And then when he puffed the smoke out, it came out. It was milk. So it looked like he was smoking underwater. He was just his idea. I don't know. I don't have time to tell you, but his whole house was wired electronically. He took a basement, and he went out and he bought the entire collection of a wine company, and he put it all in his. He had shelves built, and he put this in his basement, and then he had cobwebs put on it, so it looked like it had been there for 300 years. And upstairs, he then went through New York and found a gun and antique weapon store, and he bought all of that. And he decorated the whole upstairs, the banisters and the railings and everything, was all with these ancient weapons. And he said, it's been in the family for years, you know. And you walked into this and it felt like it was a museum and it had been there for an hour, you know. Ernie was a big child, and he was a lovable child. He was not funny in person. He was not a funny person to sit and tell. He was delightful and absorbing and interesting and well-read, and he loved literature and so forth. But he was not a funny person like a stand-up comic like Robin Williams and so forth, you know. But, boy, he sure had a wonderful mind. It changed television. And we all kind of grew up visually, comedically on Ernie Kovacs. He's a part of our culture.
Do you think that kids should be required to study the history of American film and television the way they study literature?
Yeah, but it's dangerous. Who's gonna teach it? You see, when a child is... laughter is such a part of our chemistry, you know. And I said when a child is born, you don't have to teach it how to eat, how to sleep, how to cry, and how to laugh. Hmm. And the rest of its life, we tell it when to sleep, not to cry, and to be careful of what it laughs at, you know. Hmm. It's a part of our culture that should be cultivated, and in a good sense. I mean, there's wonderful comedies on the Internet. Anybody who's interested can find places to make you laugh and people who've made you laugh, and then they can study that and they can learn, you know?
Producer and director George Schlatter will be in town to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award from the Dallas Video Fest this weekend. George, it has been an absolute delight. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think. And if you want to send email, that goes to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.